From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss Italy's response to drug trafficking through North Africa and how it's affecting groups like the Islamic State who are fighting over the region.
For the mafia, their main motivation is to make money. For ISIS or terrorist organizations, this is their secondary motivation. So anything is still on the table.
Then I'll talk with journalist Maria Armudian. Her latest book tells the stories of reporters who cover war zones, the challenges of shrinking budgets, and censorship.
And so when they're not able to do their work, as is the case in many parts of the world today, then what are we left with in terms of knowing what's happening?
The perilous future of frontline journalism, right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, you and I both study trafficking issues. Very interesting trafficking news this week about a new drug trafficking route that's been identified by Italian law enforcement, actually, through the Mediterranean, a long route that goes along the coast of North Africa and involves multiple countries. They've been able to determine that Libya, Morocco, Egypt, even the Balkans, as these drugs are making their way into Europe, are kind of transiting multiple countries, multiple actors involved. But one in which we might have interest is ISIS. It's going through ISIS-controlled territory. ISIS is taxing the shipments through that territory as it is engaging in other activities. So we've got lots of competing countries, but also militant groups, especially off the coast, that make this all the more concerning and all the more difficult for these authorities to track it and put an end to it.
Well, I think the other thing that's so interesting here is the pure quantity of drugs that are going through, specifically hashish. This was discovered a couple of years ago in 2013, where some Italian agents in the Mediterranean Ocean found a shipment, a cargo ship, so a very, very large ship, that had over 15 metric tons of hashish. This is a ton of drugs, a ton of supply, and they were completely befuddled by all of this. And so the last couple of years, they've really been trying to figure out where it's coming from, and they have discerned that this route that you mentioned. And they've been getting more and more shipments, or have apprehended folks involved in these shipments, mainly from tips from the French government, who has had a role in Libya in the past and some of these other areas. Although those tips have dried up here recently, as France has been dealing with some other issues. But just a fascinating story. What also is fascinating here, I think, is that these countries, Libya in particular, these are not countries that are known for taking drugs or for taking hashish. So this is probably some form of taxation, as you mentioned. We think that that's what's going on. ISIS-controlled territory and other parts of the area are certainly taxing drugs and other trafficked goods. So that is likely what's happening. But this is a form of payment. It's not necessarily to be sold on the streets of Libya. It's to be sent elsewhere. So very fascinating there.
Well, as we know from our previous studies, I mean, trafficking routes are usually pretty stable. But we also know that terrorists and other militant organizations are always engaged in some form of trafficking, one form or another, or multiple forms, because that's how they earn their money. Not all traffickers, of course, are terrorists, but all terrorists are usually traffickers, as we've talked about previously. But one of the things in making a distinction between these types of organizations and, let's say, general organized criminal organizations, like the mafia, for to use that term, is that the mafia seem to have a code. I mean, there seems to be, you know, limits on kind of what they do, how they operate, whereas these authorities, at least in Italy, who are quite, you know, aware of mafia organizations, there are no limits. They just operate however, and this is like raising perhaps drug trafficking activities to a whole different level.
Well, and as I said, it was an Italian official that found that first ship, and the Italians in large parts are the ones that are having to deal with this just based on geography. But you're absolutely right. For the mafia, again, if we use that term, their main motivation is to make money. For ISIS or terrorist organizations, this is their secondary motivation. They're making money to support their main motivation of some sort of political chaos or overthrow or whatever it might be. So anything is still on the table, and that's what officials are concerned about, particularly in Italy. They have experience with the mafia. They know what the mafia is capable of. They don't know what these groups are capable of, and that's pretty scary.
Yeah, and of course, watching how this trafficking grows. I mean, we know that drug trafficking often leads to human trafficking, weapons trafficking, and other things. So we'll definitely be paying attention to this issue well into the future, Rebecca. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about this conversation or questions or comments, let us know in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and get in touch with us at WorldviewsKGOU. And I tweet at Suzette Gorlot. Next, I'll talk with Maria Armudian. She's a journalist, author, and lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. And we'll talk about her latest book, Reporting from the Danger Zone, after a break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest today is Maria Armudian. She's a lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand and the host and producer of the public radio program The Scholars Circle. She's just written a book called Reporting from the Danger Zone about journalists on the front line and the future of their profession. We last spoke with her in 2013, and you can find that conversation about her work focusing on Rwanda's genocide on our website, kgou.org. Maria Armudian, welcome back to Worldviews. It's been a long time.
It is such a pleasure, Suzette. Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, last time we had a really interesting discussion about your first book, and we talked a lot about genocide and some of the issues in Rwanda and elsewhere. Now we're going to talk a little bit about your second book. As a journalist, you've written a book about the dangerous work that journalists do. You've interviewed a number of journalists, dozens of journalists around the world, not only foreign journalists, but local journalists. So tell us a little bit about what you did and why, and let's get into kind of what is the danger they're facing, because, you know, we see that on the news today, what they are facing.
Yeah, so let's back up just a bit first. And the, you know, the whole point of this second book emerged from the first book, which the conclusion was, look, it's life and death if you have bad information or bad framing. And as you said, we talked about genocide last time, because in every case of a genocide and a war, the war makers use mass media, use limited information and skewed information and often erroneous information to make a target out of a particular group. We've also seen, and this came from the first book, Kill the Messenger, that when media is used in an ethical way, it can actually end wars. It can help to end wars. On its own, it doesn't work, but it can make people stop and question, what is the point of this? Is this really the right thing to do? You know, these are really human beings on the other side. Do I really want to cause harm? And it can humanize people, which is what you actually need to have a peace process work. And so we've seen in that book, out of those case studies, that media had been used for both good purposes, peacemaking purposes, human rights purposes, democracy purposes, and also for less than positive purposes, as the Holocaust and the Rwandan genocide. So I wanted to get a little deeper into this. And since the conclusion was we need ethical journalism, we need responsible journalism, which means accurate information with responsible questions too. How do journalists do their work? And how do they choose the stories? And why do we get the stories that we get? And how do they navigate these situations? And as you noted, it's extraordinarily dangerous. Today, in many ways, more dangerous. That's partly because wars have changed. So it used to be, you know, one country versus another country, and you knew the territories and you got permission from the proper people to get into those territories. Well, you still have to get permission. But now it's not really state versus state in the same way. It's much more chaotic. You don't always know what territory you're going into if you're a journalist going to cover these things. And so there's a lot of negotiation and navigation that wasn't present in the past. So yes, I interviewed about 32 journalists. Half were local, half were foreign correspondents. They were both genders. The women were fascinating too. They really were. All different ethnicities. And I tried to get as many regions of the world so that we had a good picture, even though there's some regions I just couldn't get representation from. Most journalists really had a public interest concern. Most of them were concerned about human rights. They were concerned about humanity. And they do this work largely because of that. So they take risks that some of us, even though we're concerned also about human rights and humanity and life and death, but they take these risks to bring us information, mostly in the hopes that somebody will do something. And at minimum, it's to set the record straight. Because as you know, when people go to war, they often use information that's often misinformation to help them win a war. So it's not necessarily true what we get from either our governments or from rebel groups. And journalists, part of their job is to go and say, okay, this is what each side is saying. Is it true? And so, for example, one of the cases, one of the interviewees was Alan Little from BBC. And he had gone in during the first Gulf War along with Marie Colvin, who you may have heard of because she was shelled to her death by Bashar al-Assad. So the Iraqi government had said the U.S. had shelled a group of civilians. The allied governments, the U.S. said, no, that's not true. Nobody was killed. And so they went and they physically counted bodies. And they said, look, let this be the end of the dispute. So this is one of the things that these journalists want to do, is set the record straight. There are other cases. For example, Roy Guttman, who won a Pulitzer Prize for this particular part of his work, he was in Bosnia. And as you know, he was the guy who really discovered these concentration camps. And so he told the story of how he came to find them based on, you know, reading some material, thinking it rang true, following up, asking a lot of questions, and physically going to these places. Well, his hope was that somebody do something about this. And so he gave all his contacts to the other journalists, and he gave all the information so that it would create much more interest in it, and then they all started covering it. So it leads us to question, like, well, what do we do without these journalists, right? So the CIA didn't find these concentration camps. The Red Cross didn't find these concentration camps. It was a journalist. And so when they're not able to do their work, as is the case in many parts of the world today, then what are we left with in terms of knowing what's happening? That was part of it. Then there are many of these other cases. There's a Syrian-American woman. I'm just completely amazed by this young woman, maybe 30 years old, I'm guessing. Remained anonymous because of the way she does her work, which is dangerous. But she uses a borrowed ID. She is of Syrian descent, so she blends in with the people. She wears the local attire, goes through the checkpoints. She goes right into the territory that she wants to cover and tells these stories about what is happening to civilians in this process. Now, most of them also sort of gave up on somebody doing something. Like, they feel like this has been going on now for years and nobody is doing anything. And each side is acting worse than the other at this point. So they're saying at least we can set the record straight.
My guest is Maria Armudian, a journalist, author, and fellow public radio host. We've been talking about her latest book that focuses on journalists who report from war zones. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Let's get back to my conversation with Maria Armudian. She's an author and a journalist who's currently teaching at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. We've been talking about her latest book, Reporting from the Danger Zone, Frontline Journalists, Their Jobs, and an Increasingly Perilous Future.
So, I mean, when you talk about journalists, I mean, as you're suggesting, journalists are, there are our eyes and ears, right? I mean, they're the ones that are out there on the front lines, if you will, you know, showing us what's happening around the world. But there are also, I mean, not all journalists are the same either, right? I mean, when you've interviewed, I assume, you know, a range of journalists, but I mean, the journalism is so diffuse anymore. I mean, there's so many different venues and avenues. You've got your mainstream media, you have bloggers, you have all kinds of sources that you can trust and can't trust. I mean, you have people that have agendas, you have people that are more objective. I mean, how do we sort through that? And then what are the mechanisms that we can use to promote more ethical, professional journalism?
You know, these are huge questions. And I can say, first of all, even the mainstream outfits today are struggling with these questions. So, for example, one of the journalists, Carol Williams, who was at the Los Angeles Times, she's just retired, longtime foreign correspondent, has covered from the, you know, times of Russia when Gorbachev was there, all the way into Afghanistan and Iraq. And she says, you know, given how they're all slashing budgets now, they're not even sending us out like they used to. So I went to Crimea, she said, and told the story of how she got the information. But now they're not letting me go back. And they're expecting me to report based on these PR wires, like Associated Press type of thing, but that comes out of Ukraine. And she says, in my history, that was called plagiarism. You know, and so she's deeply uncomfortable with it. And she said, I thought it was just the LA Times, but the New York Times has got somebody doing exactly the same thing. So it's becoming so complicated now to get accurate information. Others have suggested, well, we've still got human rights groups out there, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, various human rights groups within particular countries, like Syria has one. So the expectation is, well, we put our trust in the material that's coming out of them. We still have some journalists going in. But I have to tell you, it is a morass, and it is really complicated, and I don't know if I can answer that. How do we sort through it at this point, given that even the journalism institutions that have long held two or three sources before you go to print or before you air something coming out, now we don't even know for sure that they're doing that. Very difficult. It's a tough time.
Well, indeed, the media is a business. I mean, big or small, it's a business, right?
And unless you're the BBC.
Right. I mean, you do have public access.
NPR.
And NPR, of course.
KGOU.
Our own station here. But, you know, did you sense from these journalists that you interviewed that they're concerned about around the world, this sense of kind of targeting information toward their consumers? And that, you know, when I said there are eyes and ears and they're looking at what's going on and they're telling us the story and hopefully in an objective way, I mean, how objective can they be, really? Are they worried about the information that they're bringing back kind of being targeted and edited or presented in a way that is going to a certain audience?
Yes, yes, and yes, all of the above. So first of all, they're humans. So as humans, we are not ever completely objective, right? They are guided by their own humanity most of the time. Even in the story choices, what they choose to report is often the thing that compels them is an emotional story. It is hope. It is sometimes anger or outrage at what's happening. So would you call that objective? You know, maybe not. It's still a human effort, or it's not, the effort's not the right word, but a human sort of impulse. Second thing is, yes, they are all mindful of how to present their information in a way that is appealing. So even if, so I'm trying to remember, there was a guy from Vice News who wanted to cover something in Burma. And he said, nobody's really going to be interested in this story in Burma unless I attach it to something that people are interested in. So I attached it to Hillary Clinton because of, you know, she's the person that we're talking about today. And I called it Asia's apartheid. Everybody understands apartheid. So there's that way of strategically framing so that they can appeal to their audiences.
So they'll get an audience so that they'll make it through the editing process.
Absolutely.
Right?
And a lot of them fought with editors. One of the Emmy Award-winning journalists, Terry McCarthy, told a story of they were embedded with an American Marine troop, and they actually caught on tape one of the Marines getting blown up. And he survived it. His comrade did not. But they followed him from beginning to end all the way into the hospital and his own response to that, which was, hey, I screwed up. And the editors did not want to run it. They had pixelated all the kind of blood and gore. And they said, look, people need to know this is a war and people are going to die in the war, including our people. And so they fought with that until they finally won. So there are all kinds of, you know, and then certain countries have censors. A lot of people are surprised to hear that Israel still has military censors. So journalists are told they can't publish unless they pass it through the censors. And some of them just said, oh, I published it anyway. You know, so they have their ways of getting around it. And they, most of them I found had kind of a deep commitment to getting their story out one way or the other. Although most of them also agreed no story is worth your life.
Well, in the last minute we have, can you tell me what you think? I mean, now that you've been exposed, obviously, to journalists for years, you are one yourself. I mean,
was
the future,
one long time ago, before the academic life.
What was a journalist? But you've been studying journalism for a long time, and obviously very active in the media world. Your optimism about the future of the discipline, given the dangers, given all of these complicating issues that we've discussed, you know, where do you think we're headed in this field?
You know, I think it's really complicated. I am not particularly optimistic. I think the internet has created more problems in some ways than solutions, in that in the past, traditional journalists were needed by people in order to get their story out, especially rebel groups, because they had no access to media otherwise. Today with the internet, you see all of these groups such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda using the internet. They have direct access to their audiences. So they don't need journalists anymore. This is why it is, in their view, better to kill the journalist than to let them come in and do the interviews. They're not needed. They want to tell their story their own way, and they don't want any interference with that. So I don't advocate for censorship, but there has to be some sort of a international discussion about how words matter and how frames matter, without the idea of censorship, but some kind of structures of protecting the institution of journalism.
Well, it's a long-standing industry, but still work to be done. All right, Maria, thank you so much again for joining us here again on World Peace. You've been listening to my conversation with Maria Armudian from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Shortly after we had this conversation, we turned the tables, and she interviewed me for the public radio program she hosts called The Scholar Circle. You can find a link to that conversation online at kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produces the show, and our digital content intern is Audra Bruls. They're overseen by Brian Hartzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolotte.